Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, always happy for this chance to spend time with you to share up-to-the-minute patient safety tips, tools, stories, and ideas so you can stay safe during every healthcare or hospital encounter. I'm happy you're here with me today because, as usual, I'm not at a loss for something relevant and current to talk about. Lots of recent news to share, so we may as well get started, right? Let's do it, because right now it's time for the healthcare hazards of the week. A listener sent me an article earlier this week about a hospital leaving an 8-inch fragment of a catheter tube in a patient's heart. The hospital knew about the tube for 7 years, but neglected to tell the patient. When the patient found out, the hospital was basically non-responsive. The patient sued. The hospital is fighting the lawsuit, claiming, among other things, a statute of limitations defense. And the hospital actually has a disclosure policy. Wow, after reading that, all I could do was shake my head and mutter, really? The hospital in this case is Parkland Hospital in Dallas, where President Kennedy was taken after he was shot. And the patient was Mrs. Deborah Wilson, age 59, who was actually born at Parkland, delivered her 3 children at Parkland, and received regular care at Parkland for diabetes and a heart condition, including a life-saving heart procedure in 2007. So there was this long-term relationship punctuated with some heroic care. However, according to 3 experts contacted by the Dallas Morning News, Parkland Hospital knew about the 8-inch fragment of catheter tube left in Mrs. Wilson's heart following the 2007 heart procedure that saved her life, but did not tell Mrs. Wilson until 2014. Mrs. Wilson claimed to have had 22 chest x-rays between her life-saving procedure in 2007 and in 2014, when she was finally told. The experts contacted by the Dallas Morning News say that the medical records clearly shows the hospital knew about the fragment lodged in her heart. For example, a 2012 note in her chart allegedly states that the fragment has moved higher than on examination in 2007. 1 month later, in October 2012, the Parkland doctors allegedly wrote in the chart that removing the fragment might lead to infections. Yet, allegedly, no one informed Mrs. Wilson. Going forward, the tube fragment in her heart could pose serious health problems. Well, upon learning about the tube fragment lodged in her heart, she complained to the hospital. She claims to have received a, "We regret we did not meet your expectations and we're looking into it" kind of letter. Then 2 months passed with nothing from the hospital. So she contacted the hospital again, got pretty much the same letter, except this letter promised to follow up, but only after review that may take several weeks. Mrs. Wilson felt she was getting the runaround for a very serious problem. So, Mrs. Wilson, who was born at Parkland, delivered her 3 kids at this hospital, and was a lifelong patient, sued the hospital. Now, Parkland is fighting the lawsuit with several legal theories, including statute of limitations, and this bit of lawyer speak. General knowledge that a catheter was used is not the same as knowledge that a fragment of the catheter was retained. Well, the ultimate irony is Parkland has a disclosure policy. And actually, a lot of hospitals have disclosure policies that are simply in place to meet regulatory requirements. When I visit these hospitals or nursing homes and ask the staff and leadership about their disclosure policy, I often get puzzled looks and questions like, "What disclosure policy?" Usually, only a handful of staff members even know such a policy exists, and even a smaller subset have actually read the policy. Perhaps this is the case at Parkland Hospital? Nobody has been trained in disclosure, and there is no institutional expectations or support for disclosure. Well, what's really remarkable is Mrs. Wilson gave this hospital 2 chances to get it right. She didn't run immediately to a lawyer. Instead, she returned to the hospital twice, two times, and all she got for her troubles was a couple of half-baked letters. No meeting, no follow-through, no effort to get reconnected, no nothing. In this case, there should have been a phone call followed up with an in-person meeting, then maybe a letter to memorialize everything with a date-specific next step included. Parkland Hospital should have done everything possible to maintain that relationship with Mrs. Wilson. Indeed, she did all she could to maintain the relationship, but was abandoned by Parkland, so she found a new friend, a lawyer. This really calls into question the ethics of the organization. They know they did wrong and hurt somebody. The case has bad PR and regulatory implications and could destroy their safety culture and the morale of the staff. But there might be a statute of limitation defense. Maybe we should grab onto that. So I say this because if you work at a hospital, a rehab, or a nursing home, you don't want this story to happen at your facility, but it could. If A, you don't have a good disclosure policy, B, nobody knows about the disclosure policy, C, your frontline staff are not trained on disclosure and how to show empathy, D, your legal team is a mismatch for your disclosure principles. You can't make this stuff up, folks. And that story came in just days before this bit of news in the LA Times last week. A new tally of mistakes made in American hospitals suggests that medical errors are the number three cause of death in the United States, with cancer being number two and heart problems at number one. At least 250,000 deaths each year can be attributed to medical care that has gone awry, according to a report published Tuesday in the British Medical Journal. This means that deadly mistakes are responsible for more fatalities than chronic respiratory disease, which currently ranks third on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's list of leading causes of death. The CDC currently has no good way of tracking deaths that result from medical mistakes because the agency's statistics are pulled from the International Classification of Diseases codes that appear on death certificates. These codes were instituted in 1949 and do not include any that indicate a death was the result of a mistake in the hospital. So because of that, medical errors were unintentionally excluded from national health statistics. It's obvious that the 250,000 is falsely low, and when they rely only on errors that could be documented in health records and included only deaths of patients being cared for in hospitals, medical errors outside of hospitals occur too. One way to get a better picture of the toll of medical errors would be to create death certificates that actually ask whether a preventable complication in the patient's medical care contributed to the death. Well, because hospitals don't get paid for what Medicare considers never events, harmful events that should never occur in a hospital, why would they voluntarily code that on a death certificate? Who cares if Mrs. Clutterbuck died of kidney failure or catheter-associated urinary tract infection? The family won't know the difference. Only the hospital, as they don't get paid on catheter-associated urinary tract infection cause of death. So you can see how studies and numbers can be deceivingly low. So to say that hospital errors are the third leading cause of death may not be true. It may be the second or the first. Well, whether first, second, or third, it's all equally as frightening. And here's another recent one. According to the Joint Commission Center for Transforming Healthcare, wrong site surgery occurs as often as 40 times per week in the United States. 40 times a week? All accredited organizations are required to use a pre-op verification process and surgical site marking, a process to help eliminate wrong site procedures. I want to share with you three real-life scenarios to make my point. Here's situation one. A facility did not perform a timeout for a regional nerve block by an anesthesiologist in preparation for a rotator cuff surgery. Now, a timeout is when everything and everybody stops in the operating room to verify and double-check that they have the right patient, the right body part or surgical site, and that they are, in fact, prepped to do the right procedure. Well, this timeout was erroneously perceived to be necessary only for the orthopedic surgery procedure. So the anesthesiologist blocked the wrong shoulder based on reliance of his memory of the chart. The solution? The facility's protocol now mandates separate timeout confirmations, both for a regional block insertion and for the surgical incision procedures. Two timeouts. Here's situation number two. An orthopedic surgeon properly marked multiple sites on the palm and the wrist of the same hand for multiple procedures on the patient. However, the surgery was performed on the wrong finger. The marking on the correct finger was hidden after the patient's palm was prepped and draped. The solution? The facility now requires the marking to remain observable despite prepping and draping. So, for finger surgery, the tip of the finger for the surgery, not only the palm, the tip of the finger must be marked and left exposed. Therefore, X marks the spot only if the marking can still be seen after prepping and draping. Seems pretty obvious. And here's situation number three. The surgical site was marked on an anterior leg prior to knee replacement surgery. The patient was then turned in a prone position before the anesthesiologist's arrival. Therefore, the site marking was not seen by the anesthesiologist, and the anesthesiologist relied on confirmation from the patient that, yes, this is the correct leg. However, the patient had already received a sedative and answered incorrectly, resulting in the anesthesiologist blocking the wrong leg. The solution, if possible, patient involvement in timeout now occurs before any sedation is administered and is never the exclusive method of confirmation. The new protocol also requires royal blue tape be placed around the limb to be blocked in addition to the marking of the site by the physicians. This eliminates confusion when the patient has been repositioned. The tape is also visible from all angles and requires no adjustment during patient positioning. This practice has been dubbed no blue, no block. When I was a patient, you surely cannot be awake and fully mentally functioning during a surgical timeout. But the risk of a wrong site surgery starts way before you enter the operating room. It could start as early as the time you're in the surgeon's office and it's determined that surgery is necessary. At that point, there could be a simple error in the scheduling request where a right or a left is written as the letter R or the letter L, and those letters may be illegible or they may get misinterpreted, eventually leading to the surgeon working on the patient's wrong side. And it's not just hospitals that can contribute to this mayhem. Here's another true story that actually happened to my mom. I've told you these past many weeks that my mom was back in the hospital for 10 days because she simply couldn't breathe, even while using oxygen. For maybe about 2 weeks, her breathing was becoming more and more labored, even at rest. Her nose was becoming so dry due to the constant use of oxygen. And finally, someone suggested that she call the oxygen company that furnishes her oxygen concentrator and ask for a humidifier bottle to attach to the machine. Well, they sent someone out who dropped off the bottle without any written instructions or warnings and simply told mom to use distilled water. And while I'm talking about the oxygen company, months prior, when we asked for a portable machine to use when going out to the grocery store or the bank, they delivered a handy-dandy lightweight machine that seemed perfect for the job. And I'll get back to this in a moment. Well, now her breathing eventually became so bad in conjunction with a heavy cough with discharge. When I got her to the emergency room, her oxygen level was so low that about 9 people whisked her in, each performing their magic in an effort to stabilize her that resulted in 10 days in the hospital with pneumonia and 6 weeks in rehab. Well, fast forward to last week. I brought my mom home on a Friday afternoon. Prior to her leaving, when they tested her oxygen level with the finger pulse oximeter, the little clip with the light that they attach to your finger to measure oxygen in the blood, it was 97%, and that's good, with 100% being perfect. The next day, Saturday, she was complaining of not being able to breathe again, and I wondered, was there something in the house that might be causing this? Later in the afternoon, the home health nurse came by for her initial visit and her evaluation. And when she tested mom's oxygen level with the pulse ox, it was 89. I pondered this for a moment, then I asked the nurse to come with me to take a look at the oxygen machine and the tubing. Does everything look right? I asked. Yep, looks like we have good connections. Well, 2 days later, after more difficulty breathing, mom woke up to the sound of beeping. Come to find out, it was the beeping of her oxygen machine. So we called the oxygen company, and within a short time, they showed up, used their diagnostic testing tool on the machine, and declared it was, in fact, faulty. They admonished my mom for not having it routinely checked, as if it's up to the sick patient to keep track of heavy machinery. Well, they swapped the old unit for a new one, and when the home health nurse arrived the next day, Mom's oxygen level was 98. Well, this caused me to pay some close attention to the whole oxygen situation, and I want to share this with you. Even if you don't need or use supplemental oxygen, keep these tidbits in your memory bank for future use, because they could very well be game changers. Let me go back to the handy-dandy portable machine they delivered to my mom months earlier. Every time she used it, she complained of not being able to breathe. Well, I attributed it to the fact that whenever she used it, she was getting in and out of cars, beauty shop visits, doctor visits, and such, exerting more energy than usual. But what I found out was astounding. Not all portable machines are created equally. There are two kinds of oxygen machines. One that delivers a continuous flow of oxygen that measures the output as liters per minute, and my mom is on 3 liters per minute. The other kind delivers oxygen in pulses and is measured in some other kind of metric. So the pulse dose machine is based on breathing and inhaling, whereas the continuous flow, as its name implied, is delivered at a constant rate no matter what the user's breathing. So when you see an oxygen concentrator that's said to be a single solution for on the go, at home, at sleep, it usually delivers the pulse dose type of technology. Now here's where it gets really dangerously confusing, especially when no one explains the unit to you. There are settings on both machines, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But the continuous dose is measured in liters per minute, and the pulse dose is measured by the size of the individual pulse, how often that pulse can be delivered in a minute, and when the pulse is delivered in the breathing cycle. Oh, wow, how confusing is that? So to the unsuspecting patient who doesn't know this and knows that their oxygen level is, say, 3, like my mom's, 3 liters per minute, well, then they just set their machine to 3 and off they go. The numbers on the pulse units, though, they're settings, and they're not standardized with other manufacturers. For example, a setting of 1 on a pulse unit might really be only 1/2 of a liter equivalent, which might mean that a setting at 5, the unit might only be producing 3 liters equivalent. So my mom, by setting her portable unit on 3, was probably only getting 1.5 liters per minute. Well, no wonder she couldn't breathe. The important thing to take away from all of this is don't use a unit simply because it's small, lightweight, or more convenient. Don't purchase any unit without first consulting with your pulmonary professional. Make sure you allow yourself the opportunity to try a unit, both at rest and during exertion, to determine if you are being properly saturated. And lastly, selecting the wrong unit can have severe consequences, not only to your breathing, but to your overall health. Take the time to do your homework, consult with professionals, and then determine what will work best for you. And speaking of professionals, wouldn't you think that the oxygen company would explain this and would have consulted with the physician prior to just dropping off any old machine? Well, now, back to her beeping machine. I wonder now, how long before that thing began to beep was it not furnishing the proper amount of oxygen? Was this the reason for the difficulty in breathing that led to 10 days in the hospital with pneumonia and 6 weeks in rehab? And I mentioned the humidifier bottle that the driver dropped off without explanation. My mom did not change the water every day because no one told her to do so. Did the bacterial growth in the week-old water being funneled into her nasal passages and into her lungs cause the pneumonia? Now, these are very real and valid questions. Whose responsibility is it to make sure that a leased oxygen machine is in working order? Is it the patient's responsibility? Well, if it is, then the company should give the patient the diagnostic tools and training necessary to routinely check the functioning of the machine. Personally, I don't think it's the patient's job to become an oxygen concentrator mechanic, nor do I think that a driver should simply drop off supplies without offering the educational piece necessary to a safe and successful use of the equipment. So I tell you all of these stories today, and especially this oxygen event, so that you keep harmful medical errors on your mind, not only when you're in the hospital, but at the doctor's office, and now apparently when you are at home using medical supplies too. Medical errors are the third leading cause of death. Let's stay away from that statistic. Be mindful, be vigilant, and ask questions. Or would you rather not speak up and count on the hope that others will always do the right thing?
Mrs. Clutterbuck down the street thinks it's a bad idea.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
When you're admitted to the hospital, it's important to know your status. Are you admitted as an inpatient or are you considered under observation? This bit of often secret information just might make a big difference to your wallet. Let's find out more from my friends at the Welsh Home in Rocky River. Listen as I spend the next 2 minutes with Lauren Teschner. Lauren, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good today, and I have a big question for you. How is your hospital admittance status tied to potential benefits and out-of-pocket costs?
When you're in the hospital, there are two different admission categories. You can either be inpatient or you can be an observation. People don't realize that there is a difference between inpatient and observation. People think if they've stayed there overnight, they're there for an extended amount of time, that they are automatically inpatient. We have seen people who have stayed in the observation status for 14 days, 15 days, and never were actually admitted to the hospital. The reason that you need to know the difference between these two things is your insurance benefit pays for your stay completely different when it comes to inpatient versus observation. When you are an inpatient, your insurance benefit covers much, much more of the stay than when you are in observation. The other reason that you need to know the difference between inpatient and observation is if you need to go to a facility after your hospital stay, that can play a huge role in how much your insurance will pay for that stay after the hospital.
All right, folks, you just heard a snippet about that. Be safe. Ask about your status each day you're in the hospital. And the folks at the Welsh Home know about these things and they can help you. And you don't have to be Welsh to ask for their help. Call them today to arrange for a tour or simply to ask questions. 440-331-0420. That's 440-331-0420. Or visit welshhome.com. After the show, be sure to visit the website speakupandstayalive.com for more life-saving information. Before a hospital stay pops up unexpectedly in your life, you can purchase the book Speak Up and Stay Alive, the Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide. It's found exclusively at the website speakupandstayalive.com or is available in person at all of our speaking events. Bring the book to the hospital with you. It's the best way to stand out and in a positive way. And remember, we donate 2 handmade pillowcases to either a troop member or to a local veteran shelter for every book sold. And we put your name on it as the donor. So for a mere $20, you benefit and so does some well-deserving warrior. And to help your entire group, organization, business, or church stay safe during any healthcare or hospital experience, invite me to speak. Our presentations are lively, interactive, fast-paced, and about as fun as hospital safety can be. Call 440-725-5462. Listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio, I am Pat Rulo, your hostess, and by now you know that I take great pride in bringing you only the best of the best when it comes to our guests. And today's guest fits the bill. Doug Wojcicki is a disclosure training consultant who has had several personal and professional experiences with tort reform and medical malpractice issues when he lost his oldest brother to medical errors in 1998. In 2005, he founded an advocacy organization called Sorry Works with the goal of trying to encourage physicians, hospitals, and insurers to think differently about the medical malpractice crisis and to allow these professionals to realize the solution was in their hands. The Sorry Works Coalition has grown quickly to over 4,500 members nationwide, and the group has been publicized in countless publications, including Time Magazine, National Review, National Law Journal, and American Medical Association News. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be talking to your audience today. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Doug, is it okay to share your brother's story with us so that we can understand what you were doing at the time and how his experience prompted you to create Sorry Works?
Sure. My brother Jim walked into a Cincinnati, Ohio hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning complaining of chest, shoulder, neck, and stomach pains, you know, all the classic signs of a heart attack. And Jim was a big, burly, tough guy, kind of guy that got asked to play football in high school. So for him to show up in an emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning without mom and dad shoving him there meant something was really wrong. So he gets to the emergency room, and the doctor said, well, look at you. You're built like a brick house. You're a big, strong guy. You're 39 years old. You're kind of young. Must be something wrong with your stomach, to which my brother replied, or maybe my heart. And they did do an EKG that evening. They found a murmur in his heart. My brother replied, I've never had any heart issues as far as I know, and I'm sure hurting up there. And they said, well, again, look at you. You're 39 years old. You're built like a brick house. They gave him an ulcer cocktail for a couple hours, and they sent him home without drawing his blood. A few hours later, so they released him around 5 in the morning, around 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. My parents, they had to bring him back because by the time he was starting to pass out, the oxygen levels in his blood were going that low. They get him back in the same hospital, get him back in the same emergency room. By mid-morning, they draw the blood, churn up the enzymes of the blood, showing the heart is at stress being damaged. And by early afternoon, they have him in the intensive care unit. And this is where the poles of the Swiss cheese, as we say in patient safety, started to line up. The computer monitor over my brother's bed read, Ray Wachesek. Ray Wachesek. My brother's name was Jim. Who's Ray? That's my dad. Very significant because my dad had a heart stress test done in this very same hospital just a couple months prior to my brother's passing. Dad had a perfect cardiac workup at that time, no blockage. In fact, the cardiologist told me he knocked the machine off the wall, then wrote in the chart he's got the heart of a 30-year-old man. So fast forward a couple months down the road, there's my dad looking at a computer monitor with his name on it, but his oldest son was in the bed, went and got the attending physician, said, wait, I think there's been a mix-up. I'm Ray, that's Jim. They wanted to argue with him about who was who. Dad pulled out driver's licenses, and they eventually changed the computer monitor, but not before they were using Dad's charts to form a diagnosis of a bacterial infection of the heart. For 2 days, they plugged Jim full of antibiotics. He was admitted on a Tuesday. He died on a Thursday evening. Last afternoon of his life, he was spitting up blood. He was in extreme pain. He was really going downhill. They decided to run a probe up his leg, and sure enough, they found 4 arteries blocked. He crashed during the test and died in emergency open-heart surgery. The damage was simply too great. And the surgeon who had been brought in at the last minute to try to save his life had not been involved in his care up to that point, was furious when he walked out of the operating room, went up to my parents and said, if the jerks at this hospital had done their job and got your boy to me 2 days ago, they should have. I could have saved them. We do bypasses all the time, but the damage is too great. After that, the wall of silence went up. Nobody would speak to my parents. Nobody would talk to them. Even the surgeon, who was so honest that night, said, look, the lawyers told me not to speak. And it was a cover-up. So we had to file a lawsuit. And long story short, we were successful in that litigation as far as getting money. But at that time, we did not get any apology, any acknowledgement, or even explanation of what went so wrong, how they're going to fix it. So that was a real strong motivation to get in this work. And I've done, at that time, cases being settled. I was doing a lot of work on tort reform for both of the medical community as well as the plaintiff's bar. And the personal experience, along with my professional stuff, where I was seeing these two groups basically talk past each other and not really get to the reason why people file lawsuits or what makes patients and families so angry, I said to myself, there's got to be a different way. A few hospitals are starting to pick up this approach of just being honest and disclosing and taking care of people. And so we came up with the term Sorry Works to describe this process, give an identity, and see if we could help it get legs. And sure enough, it's absolutely taken off over the last few years.
Wow, that's an amazing story. You wonder how you can recover from something like that as a family.
Both my parents are Depression-era kids, so they've seen tough times. They know bad stuff. And my mom was very blunt. She said, look, you're devastating to all of us, especially me. My brother was like a second father. And my mom said, look, you know, you can go on living or you can lay down and die. You know what your brother wants you to do. And the time when he died, I didn't know I'd be doing this, but the opportunity presented itself, and it's been very meaningful and provided a lot of closure and healing for not only me, but my entire family. And we know that it's work has helped a lot of people, not only patients and families, but doctors and nurses too, because doctors and nurses sometimes suffer as bad or even worse patients and families if something goes wrong. They're human beings too, and they chew themselves up, literally, including a lot of suicides. And they're not allowed to talk about these things and get the closure and healing they need just as badly as any patient or family.
Right, that's understandable. Talk to us about the difference between empathy and apology.
Empathy is what should happen after something goes wrong in a hospital. Now, I say something goes wrong, I'm not exactly talking about malpractice or an error, or we know for sure someone's at fault, just something's gone wrong. There's a known complication, and there's an upset patient, upset family, upset caregivers. What we teach people at Sorry Works is that when something goes wrong, the doctor, the nurse, the hospital, the practice, the whatever, needs to go out and empathize, say, you know, Pat, I'm sorry this happened. I feel horrible for you. We're going to do a review, figure out what happened, and we're going to stay in touch, and we're going to figure this out together. That is empathy. Even though you said sorry, there's no omission or fault there. Apology would be, Pat, I'm sorry, I screwed up. We did the procedure wrong. It's all our fault, and we owe you something. That would be apology. Both phrases use the word sorry, but empathy is just about showing concern and compassion and why is that connected, whereas apology is about admitting fault and making amends. We really teach that to our doctors and nurses, as well as patients and families, because there's confusion out there about that, and there's a lot of fear around the S word, sorry, in medicine, because for so long, doctors and nurses have been told never to say it because you'll get the hospital sued. And we tell doctors and nurses, no. It's the context and how you say it and the way you present it. And empathy is absolutely appropriate because we know one of the biggest drivers of med mal litigation, one of the big reasons patients and families file lawsuits because no one ever says sorry. Nobody ever says sorry. No one ever shows they care or they continue to care. And I can't tell you how many times I've had patients and families talk to me as I do this work and say, they say to me, gee, golly whiz, Doug, if someone just would have said they're sorry, we wouldn't be in the midst of this whole lawsuit. It happens all the time.
Right. I experienced that myself in a situation with my mom where no one ever showed empathy. No one ever gave an apology. And, you know, people don't want to sue. It's a lengthy and grueling process. It's not what people are looking to do. And perhaps if they got a little conversation from the other end, it might be helpful. Is an apology synonymous with disclosure? So if someone apologizes, can now that be an admission of, yes, we did something wrong, and does that open the door to lawsuits, or does it reduce lawsuits?
No, it reduces lawsuits, and you got to be careful about your wording. You know, disclosure is many things. It's empathy, communication, it's talking about what we know when we know it, and it includes apology. When you have a credible review, it can include apology. When you have a credible review involving outside experts, it says, yeah, you know, the care was not good here. You know, the standard of care was not met, or it was breached. Disclosure is just, you know, it's a catch-all term for post-event discussions with patients and families. Apology is a subset, if you will, of after the review shows we made a mistake, after the review confirmed a mistake, then we're going to go and apologize and admit fault. They never were taught this stuff in medical school or nursing school. I say to doctors and nurses, if you're concerned about litigation, if you're afraid of getting sued, if you're afraid I'm going to run to a lawyer and pop off and sue you, the best thing you can do for yourself and for me is to stay connected with me. Mm-hmm. Because when relationships are broken and I lose total faith in you, I have no faith in you to fix my problems or to address my needs, that's when I go find a new friend. That's when I go find the attorney and we sue you. So staying connected, and if you made an apology, taking care of it, you know, I can't tell you how many plaintiff's attorneys have told me through my travels that doing all those things takes away the reason for litigating. There's nothing to litigate about. If you got an honest person trying to take care of a problem, there will be discussions and maybe even mediation, but why would we go to the courthouse? Well, there's no reason. There's nothing to argue about.
Right. Do healthcare providers have to get some kind of clearance, say, from risk management department or the legal department of the hospital before they can voluntarily speak to a patient about what happened or before they apologize for an incident?
As far as the empathy piece, you know, staying connected post-event, you really don't need, quote, clearance.
Right.
Good idea to be trained. And, you know, a lot of times when we come into a hospital or work with an insurance company, we're coming through risk or claims or legal administration here. They're the ones that are teeing it up with the docs and nurses. And that's the big challenge right now. A lot of organizations, healthcare systems, insurance companies around the country actually adopt, are moving towards or already have adopted disclosure. The challenge for them is how do you get this message down to thousands of doctors and thousands of nurses? How do you do it? And that's stuff we're working on. Sorry Works. We have a new online learning program. We've partnered with the Elm Company, Elm Exchange, to make this something that get the message down to these folks. So a lot of organizations are moving towards this, and they want their people to stay connected post-event because they know, they've known through years of doing this, that when docs run away, nurses grow cold or break off communications, that's when the lawsuits happen. As far as apology, you know, admitting a fault and saying, hey, the hospital owes you something, you need to pause before you do that. The worst thing that can happen, Pat, and I've heard sad stories around the country where disclosure is coming online. Sometimes doctors get a little exuberant, if you will, and they run out to the family and they say, oh my God, we just killed your sister. We just killed your child. It was all our fault. We, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then the review comes back and says otherwise. The family will never believe otherwise. You know, they will always believe that that doctor or that nurse said malpractice, that, you know, you killed my loved one. And they'll go crazy. You know, it doesn't matter what their own lawyer tells them, doesn't matter what the judge or jury tells them. They will go crazy. For not only for the protection of the hospital or the insurance company, but also the protection of the patient and family, we always encourage and tell doctors and nurses to be very slow before apologizing. Be quick to empathize. Be quick to stay connected and meet the immediate needs of your patient or family. Wrap your arms around these people and take care of them more so than you did pre-event. Be slow to admit fault. you know, even in a circumstance like a wrong side surgery where everyone can see you made a mistake, even in that, you have to be careful. You can say, look, supposed to operate on the left knee, we're operating on the right knee. We're sorry that mistake happened. We need to figure out how that mistake happened. We're not going to throw Dr. Smith under the bus or throw the nursing staff under the bus. We need to figure out what happened and then come back in due time.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you want to stay with us. This is Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. I'm Pat Rulo, and we are talking with Doug Wojcicki, founder of Sorry Works. And we're learning about the doctor and hospital disclosure and apologies when confronted with an adverse patient event. What about the patient? I'm sure the patient has some kind of responsibility too, or ways that they can help keep those lines of communication open and transparent. What can we as patients do to see to it that happens?
It's a great question. I appreciate asking this because this is a new project we're working on. Earlier today, I was writing a text for a booklet that we're going to be putting out shortly before Christmas, early December. We've done a lot of work educating doctors and nurses and, you know, healthcare and insurance and legal professionals about disclosure, and they're coming around and they're getting where they need to be. But patients and families are often woefully uneducated about what to do post-event. Regardless of if there's disclosure or not, that most folks just don't know what to do after something goes wrong. And they have no idea what they should expect. They have no idea how to navigate the system. They have no idea to get what they want. If they need to find a lawyer, they have no idea how to do that. They just have no idea. And sometimes it's not only to their detriment, it's to the hospital detriment. I can't tell you how many times I talk to risk managers who work in very ethically minded hospitals who say it drives them crazy. When they are willing to sit down and talk with a patient or a family and fix the mistakes they've made, and the family won't return a phone call. The family won't sit down and meet. They run away and hide. And it's kind of ridiculous. And I can't tell you how many times I've talked with plaintiff's attorneys about this, and they say, it is ridiculous. They say there's no harm in the family going back to the hospital and sitting down and listening. Because either one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to get what you need as far as what you need financially and otherwise, or, you know, acknowledgement and otherwise, or you have the door slammed in your face. And that get the door slammed in your face, that creates a lot of great evidence for a lawsuit. Either way, you can't lose. So in this booklet, we're going to put a lot of the very basic things teaching patients and families how to react, how to navigate, what they can do, what they shouldn't do after something goes wrong so they can maximize their chances to get what they need, get the closure and healing they need after something goes wrong in a medical setting.
Well, good. I look forward to that. You need to keep me posted on that. Something that I would like to share with our listeners. And I do a lot of speaking events. That might be something to take on the road as well.
Absolutely.
Because I don't know, does that come from anger, fear, or ignorance when you're in the situation you've never been in before? How would you know how to react? And so I guess we need to be taught.
Yeah, my family's been through malpractice twice, Pat, and we've been successful both times in getting resolution of the cases, both those cases. But talk to most med mal plaintiff's lawyers, they reject 99% of the cases that come in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Well, sometimes there's no malpractice, but I think a lot of times it's because patients and families just have no idea how to organize their case, how to market their case to a prospective lawyer, and how to sell themselves, and how to behave, and how to work within that system, and how to get the attention of an otherwise busy lawyer, busy law firm. So those are things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about all that stuff. What my goal out of this project is not to generate more lawsuits. The goal is to educate patients and families like we've educated doctors and nurses so that when things do go wrong, both these camps, patient family camp and the doctor nurse camp, are pushed towards each other and working together, and we get quicker, fair resolution to these things without having to go to the courthouse.
You know, sometimes, though, it's just the little things. People are already fearful and angry. And I remember after my mom spent 4 months in the hospital due to one giant misdiagnosis, the hospital and the surgeon sent a satisfaction survey. So it was obvious that we were on some kind of a list that no one looked at, or perhaps the mailings were done by a third party who doesn't know that the hospital staff and the surgeon nearly killed a person, yet they're sending this. Yeah. And it's those little things sometimes that can really get under a person's skin and maybe close the doors.
That's right. Yeah, and that's one of the things we teach. You know, we teach a lot of things in Sorry Works, including, for example, when we work with hospitals, shutting down all institutional communications post-event. It's not that we're not going to communicate with the patient or family, but they're just not going to hear from the organization. They're going to hear from an individual within the organization or a group of individuals that they know. So that means we're going to, like in your mom's case, we're going to shut down the satisfaction surveys. In my family's case, you know, we got a bill after my brother passed, and it outraged my mother. Mm-hmm. We also got a form letter. It was a sympathy letter addressed to Mrs. Jim Wojcicki. Whoops, he wasn't married. We're going to shut down the fundraising letters and the marketing magazines and all those things, like you said, that can just take the roof off the house.
Yeah.
And close down the channels of communication that can benefit everybody, not just patients and families, but also doctors and nurses. So we need to be very smart about it. And disclosure organizations, know, like University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago, with one click of a button on a keyboard, all that stuff comes to a grinding halt. And it doesn't get started again until the disclosure team says it gets started again. So we got to be smart. We got to be thoughtful, because you're right. Simple little things like that, stupid little things like that, can just take the roof off the house.
Right. It's a very sensitive time for everyone involved. I know that. Doug, yeah. How can our listeners learn more about you and what you do?
They can come to our website, sorryworks.net, 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 or call my cell phone, 618-559-8168.
Well, that's being very accessible. Doug, I thank you for being on our show today. You've certainly brought to light a delicate subject that, as a patient, I want to see more of: empathy and disclosure and basic regard for another person and their loved ones. And I thank you for tackling such an important piece of healthcare and patient safety.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to share this message with your audience. Thank you so much.
Tired of the same old presentations?
Can you forward to slide 38, please?
Are you looking for a new, out-of-the-box topic for your next event?
Want your group to leave inspired, informed, and satisfied?
No PowerPoint presentations and dim lights here. No snoring or snoozing goes on during Pat's presentations. To help your entire group, organization, business, or church stay safe during any healthcare or hospital experience, invite Pat to speak. Pick a topic from her website or request your own. Visit her website, speakupandstayalive.com, or call Pat to discuss how she can make your next event fun, enlightening, and life-saving.
Want testimonials?
Go to the bulletin board link at the website for color pictures and comments from real people. Again, it's speakupandstayalive.com, or call 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462.
You've found the safest place to be when it comes to healthcare and hospital safety. This is Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, author of the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide. It's a book that needs to be on everyone's coffee table. And if you'd like to support this program, please purchase a copy for yourself and for your friends. Proceeds fund the Pillowcase Project, where we send handmade, one-of-a-kind pillowcases to veteran shelters and now to women's shelters, too. Be a part of the solution and help us help others. When you buy a book, we send a pillowcase with your name as the donor. So right after the show, visit the website speakupandstayalive.com or call me to purchase the book. 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. Well, today I want to share a few emails with you just to mix things up. So Bob was supposed to be here to help out. Is Bob here?
Oh my God, I didn't see him. I think he went to play golf.
Oh my goodness, is that you, Rush L?
Yes, it is. I don't know where Bob is.
Oh, all right, well, we don't have much time to wait for him, so Rush, would you do the honors today and help out and read some of the emails?
Oh my God, I would love to do that. Okay, where are they?
I think they're by Bob's microphone.
Okay. Well, here's one from Suntree in Ohio. She says, I am elderly and have some medical issues, and I have had so many home health agency girls come to my home to supposedly help me. I've had girls on drugs, girls who steal, girls who either can't or pretend they can't cook a thing or clean a thing. I've had so many admit what they are using, and one gave herself heroin. That's right, Pat, I said heroin at my kitchen table, then staggered out of the door mumbling about an emergency room. The state of Ohio doesn't require them to be drug tested. Why?
Oh my, well, Suntree, you are correct. The state of Ohio does not require drug testing for home care workers, and other states as well, I'm sure. And at the state's website, they do say that Ohio permits drug testing. So they don't demand it, but they permit it. There are no federal laws or regulations that require home health agencies to conduct background checks prior to hiring individuals or to periodically conduct background checks after an individual has been hired. To me, this is clearly a very wrong practice, and shame on the state for not having reasonably accountable protocols. However, this doesn't mean that individual home health care agencies don't require drug testing. Many, many do. So inquire before you hire. And in SunTree's case, you might consider reporting this to the state of Ohio, to Medicare, to Medicaid, or to whomever the home health agency is that you're using. Sad commentary.
Oh my God, that is just horrible.
Yes, it really is.
Okay, Pat, I think we have time for one more. A nice nurse writes, is an antibacterial soap safe for healthcare workers?
Well, I just asked this myself a few weeks ago when I went to the doctor with Bob. While waiting in the exam room for 30 minutes, I examined everything, and this included the ingredients in the hand soap on the wall. The main ingredient was triclosan. Now, this is different from the alcohol rubs like Purell, which are made purely of alcohol and are safe. So I did a little digging. The FDA is currently reviewing the effect of triclosan, an antibacterial agent commonly found in soap, cosmetics, skin creams, and some brands of toothpaste. They're looking at the effects on hormone levels. The agency is concerned it may cause side effects, such as an interference with hormones and fetal development problems. And this is according to research from the University of California at San Francisco. And by now, if you know me, you know that I don't have much respect for the FDA. According to Paul Blank, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, who did some studies, he says, if non-triclosan-containing soaps are available, use the alternative. This is based on the precautionary principle. That is, if you don't know for certain that something is unsafe, it is better to err on the side of caution. In the meantime, Blank recommends healthcare workers use plain old soap and water, but he said the burden is on the FDA to determine as soon as possible whether triclosan is safe, rather than leaving individuals to scrutinize every product they use for the chemical. Don't know what they're waiting for. Failure to adhere to hand hygiene protocols is a major problem within healthcare, and we all know that. In fact, a 2013 survey found that only 13% of emergency medical providers wash their hands before contact with patients. So now if they have to worry that triclosan is a health hazard to them, guess what? They probably won't be washing their hands 13% of the time. Wow.
Oh my God, that's very, very interesting. I know about hand washing. I see that all the time at Dr. Very Busy's office.
Well, I'm sure you see all kinds of things there, Rochelle. Well, wow, we had lots of interesting emails this week, but only have time for these right now. But keep sending us your thoughts on any subject. Send them to pat@speakupandstayalive.com, or you can call me 440-725-5462. Well, we still have Bob missing in action, but Rush L, thank you for stepping in. I did not know you were in town today.
Oh my God, yes, I had to be with some family members for some very important business, but I thought I'd stop in, and I thought Bob would be here, so I don't know where he is.
I know. I don't know where he is either. I'm sure we'll locate him soon. Well, thank you for joining us, Rochelle. And friends, don't go anywhere. We're not finished yet.
So do you think I'll be able to find Bob before I leave today? Oh my gosh, I think I see him. Bob, is that you, Bob?
Well, my friends, we are somehow out of time. But at least we jammed the time we had with lots of things to think about. And my biggest takeaway for you today is this. If you or someone you know uses an oxygen machine, either the big concentrator in the home or the portable one, please do two things this week. First, have someone from the company come out to service them to make sure they are in fact in tip-top shape and working order. And secondly, if you have high-use oxygen needs, at a setting of 3 liters per minute or more, keep in mind that the lightweight portable units are most likely a pulse dose machine and they are not capable of delivering this high amount of oxygen. I'm not talking about those green tanks of oxygen, but the one that looks like a satchel with a carry band, the portable ones. Now, there are some units that you could pull, much like a stewardess's piece of luggage, and those are dual machines, and you can switch from pulse dose to continuous flow. but they are not the portable ones that you could actually carry on your shoulder. Bottom line, get someone who knows what they are talking about and make sure you have the correct unit for your needs. And as your needs change, you may need to change units as well. If you do that this week, I'll sleep a whole lot better. All right, we really do have to go now, so come back next week. Same time, same place, but you know me, never the same information. And until then, get a copy of my book, It Is Your Hospital Survival Guide. Go to the website, speakupandstayalive.com, or call me and order by phone, 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. Well, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week, free from beeping oxygen tanks. I am Pat Rulo, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Make a splash with a season pass that screams fun. Pioneer Waterland and Drive Fun Park in Chardon, Ohio has discounted season passes. Buy now and save. Family pass for $4, $195. Additional family member and individual passes discounted too. That includes a free parking pass for the entire season. Order your season passes today at pioneerwaterland.com or by phone 440-285-5200. That's 440-285-5200. Imagine for a moment that you're sitting in the doctor's office or in a hospital bed, all shivery and full of anticipation. Your doctor finally walks in and extends a hand looking to shake yours. Do you obligingly shake this don't-know-where-you've-been hand, or do you run for the door? I'm Pat Rulo, host of Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I'm talking about cross-contamination. It's not rude or weird to ask your healthcare providers to wash their hands before touching you, and I have a perfect solution called the Icebreaker Card. When your doctor extends that germy hand, simply hand him or her your card that says, "I'm concerned about healthcare-acquired infections. Please wash your hands before touching me." With Ebola, the enterovirus, and who knows what else on the horizon, you must be in charge of your own healthcare safety. For more patient safety tips and tools, tune in to Speak Up and Stay Alive every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on WHKW AM 1220. And to purchase the cards, the book, and more, visit speakupandstayalive.com.